Dalian Wallace are an embarrassment and a disgrace.
Dalian Wallace are an embarrassment and a disgrace.
Dalian Wallace are an embarrassment.
Dalian Wallace are an embarrassment and a disgrace.
Well, Wallace is an embarrassment. Daly is a disgrace.
I'm starting to think it's true. Let's start again. Ready?
Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness. This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the net to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say, so what?
The police in riot here with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
The recognition of Guaido,
unelected gobshite,
is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and I would reprimand you over that.
Hello, and welcome to I Foresee Trouble with Dalian Wallace. We are recording here.
And Howard.
And Howard. We are recording here from Lesbos, a Greek island just off Turkey. And we are here as part of a campaign against the criminalisation of asylum seekers to support two Afghan asylum seekers, Amir Zahiri and Akif Razuli, who were charged with 50 years each for facilitating illegal entry. Today was their appeal. Can you tell me a bit about what happened?
Well, I suppose yesterday was supposed to be their appeal, Patrick's Day, and when we met them last November, a promise that we'd return for this long-standing case. Nothing happened yesterday. We were hanging around basically all day. And then we came to today, and again, was it going to happen? Was it not going to happen? And then the court had said that it was finishing at 3 o'clock, and at about 2:30, it finished on a preceding case and said, oh, we need to consider this case and then we'll come back. And they brought everybody back into court, and I have to say it was really devastating. I mean, we were very upset, which just gives an indication of what the families and the two lads were going through at that time. Them and us couldn't understand what was going on because none of us spoke Greek, and neither did they, obviously. But the heel of the hunt was that they had decided to postpone the case until the 7th of April. Now, on the one hand, that's devastating. It means another 20 days before these two innocent people will get their day in court, having been in prison for nearly 2 years anyway. I mean, the saddest thing was we saw the little boy who was the son of Amir, who wasn't born when he was arrested. When they came on the boat, his wife was pregnant. The little young fella is running around now and he's in prison for something he didn't do. They were the victims of a people smuggler, and they're the ones who are up in court. It's just... It's sickening, the whole thing. So the case has been put off until the 7th of April. It had made a big stir that we were there, that members of the European Parliament were there. Myself and Mick were there with Stelios Kalouglou, our left colleague from Syriza in the left group, and Clara Ponseti from the Catalans non-aligned group. So the four of us were there as witnesses. It has caused a bit of a stir in the Greek media. The judges obviously didn't know what to do, but anyway, they've done bloody nothing this time except put it off until the 7th of April. But I mean, it's been a bit of a roller coaster, hasn't it, making the sense of, you know, I suppose for us, just listening to everything about the sympathy and the great outpouring of sympathy for the Ukrainians, and to come over here then and witness the way other migrants and asylum seekers are being treated, and just the sharp contrast is frightening.
Yeah, it's just so bad how we can treat other people. We went to the camp yesterday as well, where the numbers have been dramatically reduced. There's about 1,200 people in the camp, I think, and 1,200 people in the camp. They're supposed to be able to go freely to the town and back. Over 500 of them are supposed to have a passport now that can allow them to move within the EU for about 3 months, but it's almost a lot of them would be afraid to even leave, because after 3 months they could be just sent back to the country they came from, where many of them have fled either war or persecution already in one form or another. So it's just soul destroying to see all these people be brought into a camp, which isn't how we should deal with people looking for a place of safety, a place that they can live and make a living and care for their families. But that's exactly what's happening. We are criminalizing refugees and migrants on the move, and that is an absolute shame on the European Union. And it goes without saying, everyone is very much focused on what's happening in Ukraine for the last 4 weeks, and the war in Ukraine is terrible, and we've condemned it 100%. The Russian invasion is completely wrong. It's against international law, and it may involve war crimes, but there's war crimes obviously been taking place for many years by many, and it doesn't seem anyone has been held to account. But if you compare the plight of the people that we've seen today as against the plight of the Ukrainians fleeing, you have to be forgiven for making the comparison. And Ireland has now let in, as of yesterday evening, we had accepted 8,000 Ukrainians, and fair play for accepting them. But the number of Afghans or Syrians or Iraqis or Yemenis that we've been prepared to accept are just over the last 10 years have been a fraction of that number. And you have to ask why. Mm. And sadly, I can't help feeling, but the level of racism that's predominant in Europe has never been so badly exposed by what's going on at the moment.
Well, I think for me, there was a couple of things. I mean, what's going on in Greece now is obviously it's a deliberate policy at pushback. So they're actually not allowing people land. It's not that the numbers have slowed down. And we had unconfirmed reports this morning of another 7 bodies washing up on the island of Lesbos with no papers, no documents, which means that they were intercepted by state forces somewhere and probably put back to sea, and they drowned as a consequence. And that's happening all the time here. So literally human beings are drowning, and it's not getting commentary anywhere. The camp that Mick was talking about there, I mean, 270 police to monitor that camp, not to mind private security and all the rest. All of this money that the EU is pumping in is towards border securitization and so on. And I mean, we've been to many refugee camps before, but personally, I found it one of the hardest yesterday. Not that the conditions were any worse than any of the other ones, but contrasting it with the outpouring of sympathy for Ukraine, because as always, when you go to these camps, people see you're there, and they just, the word goes out and they all come around you, and they're all pushing and they're getting fellas to translate and to try to tell you their own story. Like, and at one stage, we must have had about 25 Somali young fellas around us, and they all spoke great English. And they were all saying, look, we just want to work. We want to live. We don't, they just send us here. We just eat, come back, our papers. Nobody can get papers. So an Afghan woman, 10 children in her family, a sick husband, and she's just there pleading with us to do something. And in the freezing cold in this camp of tents, like, it was just, it's barbarous by comparison with what's going on elsewhere. It's just horrific, and no one's talking about it. And they're the lucky ones. They're the ones who made it to the island. Others have drowned and are drowning every day, and nothing has been done about it.
Well, it's scary to see there's 2 massive Greek Coast Guard ships of a military design in the waters here right in front of us. And to think that these boats are predominantly used to stop people from getting to Europe, and in the case of the 7 bodies washed up this morning on the island here, it does, as Claire said, it does appear that their papers were taken. They were pushed back out to sea to drown. But there's not a word about what's happening down here right now. Mm-hmm. And the European Union are responsible for pushing people back into the Mediterranean to die, not giving a goddamn about these lives. They don't matter to them.
And so how is the EU exactly letting this happen? I know that, Claire, you've been in the Libby Committee in front of Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson, and you've personally asked her about this, and particularly about the EU Facilitators Directive. What did she respond to you on this?
Yeah, I mean, look, there is an argument, and it's true, that there is an EU directive about combating smuggling, and obviously everybody would be opposed to smuggling. The idea of preying on vulnerable people and taking money off them is disastrous, and that does need to be challenged. But the EU brought in a directive on this, very ambiguous. It's not in line with the UN protocol against migrant smuggling, which says that, yes, smuggling is wrong, but humanitarian aid, humanitarian assistance and vulnerable migrants in distress cannot be confused with a people smuggler. But that's exactly what's happened in Greece. They transposed the directive in a way in which other member states haven't, which means they've utterly, as makes it, criminalised humanitarian assistance. And we saw it with the case of Sean Binder, the Irish activist who was up in court here a number of months ago. His case, a big media attention on it with some other volunteers, and the court just dragged it out and postponed it. And that's gone back for months and months and months. We thought something like that might have happened with Amir and Rasuli today, but it didn't. There was a bit of a fudge. So they decided they didn't postpone it indefinitely, which could have meant the lad's been in prison for another year. But they postponed it until the 7th of April. So we need to put a massive pressure on the European Commission and, you know, the Greek government as well to say this is not on. Like,
yeah, you'd really wonder how in God's name, I mean, the EU's facilitators package on smuggling doesn't align with the UN smuggling protocol, as Claire pointed out, and it doesn't comply with international human rights law or refugee law.
Mm.
And I mean, Greece, now what the EU has done then after that, not only is it out of line, it's the EU's own package out of line with the UN smuggling protocol, but then the EU allows each member state to almost interpret it as they see fit, apply it as they see fit, and Greece has been one of the most criminal of all of the EU states in its implementation of the EU legal framework on smuggling, right? And I mean, they're making no effort to show any compassion. They're completely ignoring the human rights of the individuals coming to their shores, and they're criminalizing them instead of helping them. And the EU boasts about the money it spends on this, but as Claire said, most of the money is going on policing, on security, and it's all about keeping these people out, despite the fact that EU member states have played a significant role in helping the Americans to destroy these countries, to destroy their communities, which forced them to flee their own country in pursuit of an opportunity to make a living, to feed their families somewhere else.
Mm.
And all we are doing is criminalizing them. It's an absolute disgrace. And the European Union, I'm sick to the back teeth of the European Union talking about the European Union of values. What fucking values are they talking about?
Well, it was Ursula von der Leyen who gave the nod. She said Greece could be Europe's shield. And what she meant was, we'll send in the militarism, we'll send in the money, lock up your borders and don't let them in. And Greece have done that, got away with that. And the human beings at the forefront of it were there. I mean, I suppose we should balance it by saying that on the other side, we've seen the very best of humanity. So here, the volunteerism, the lawyers, the NGOs, the activists, the just ordinary men and women on the island who kind of come out with a bit of compassion, a blanket, a cup of tea, make sandwiches, bring children into their homes, just mind them, collect them. And those activities are being criminalized too, but it gives you a glimpse of the other side. But I mean, I think acutely they were aware, and we got this a lot, of the double standards in the response between the Ukraine crisis and their crisis.
And emphasizes once more the huge gulf between the people of Europe who care and the institutions of the European Union, which don't.
Mm.
The European Union has a major disconnect from the people of Europe. And as we have been saying repeatedly, the European Union now has become a right-wing neoliberal club that represents the interests of big business and does not represent its own ordinary people. And it's a huge challenge for the EU if it intends to survive going forward. If they don't change tact, it's going to have huge problems because they are losing the support of the ordinary people of Europe.
We've got a huge problem now in Europe, and I wonder what you think. Should I read Kevin Higgins' new poem point in time? Because Europe's racism, in terms of the contrast in their response in general with what's happening in Ukraine, is beginning to filter into the consciousness of people. So maybe will I read Kevin's latest poem? Yeah. Kevin is our poet from the West. He did a great poem there on the war, which was actually translated into Russian as well by a Russian activist. And it's available on our Facebooks and social media sites. But he did a poem today called White, and I think I'll read it. He says, "So now they are bombing white people with bombs not officially signed off on by the people who sign off on such things. Television and internet are laden with white people fleeing their houses, many of which are no longer technically houses, into any country that'll have them, which is pretty much any country they want. The leader of the white people flashes around the world, or at least on your smartphone, dressed up as a hero. Elderly white women everywhere pray he'll marry their daughters, a few even that he'll take on one of their bachelor sons as his wife. White people everywhere race to register their sorrow for those whose white bones and even whiter faces make them ill-suited to having bombs dropped on them. Those of us who live in half a shed will happily share our half a shed with the white people, their children if needs be, can rest their heads on our mousetraps. And we'll all be heroes, which is well and good. But when will the world get back to just bombing brown people?" So that's Kevin's latest poem, and I think it pretty much sums it up, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. I can't help feeling that the last 4 weeks has done more to expose the blatant racism of Europe, of the institutions of Europe, and of the mainstream media in Europe. When the people of Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen, countries that we've helped to destroy, are not welcome on our shores. We spend a fortune making sure they can't get in. We criminalize them. We make them drown at sea. And we have open arms for others that are deemed more fitting for our shores. It is racism. 100%.
And they're exploiting the people of Ukraine for geopolitical reasons as well. And I mean, that has, as we meet again, the war is still underway. The devastation is continuing. The loss of lives has grown. The numbers of people leaving Ukraine is escalating. And there doesn't seem to be any end in sight.
And the sad part about it is that the biggest loser in all this are the people of Ukraine. There's more and more people dying in Ukraine. Putin's war is 100% wrong. It's illegal. It's terrible. Unfortunately, the European Union is doing bugger all to make it stop. The US and NATO don't even want it to stop.
And well, that's the key thing. I mean, I think you're totally right. I mean, I said there's no end in sight, but actually, you know, there have been supposedly talks. The Russians have outlined a plan as to what might be the basis of a resolution and a cessation of hostilities in that regard. And what I find the maddest thing is here we're talking about people who are screaming into the media every day about how horrific the war is, but they don't seem to be concentrating at all on how we might stop it. There doesn't seem to be any attention given to the potential of a ceasefire arrangement, or when they talk about, oh, yeah, yeah, we want hostilities to finish. But then they're piling in the extra armaments. They're escalating the talk about, say, you know, Zelensky's on about, oh, yeah, we want a no-fly zone. Oh, yeah, we want to join the EU. And meanwhile, the conflict is continuing, you know. And
people should understand that a no-fly zone is a situation where if Russian planes fly over Ukraine, then they'll be shot down by US NATO planes. You're talking World War III. And anyone recommending that, which Zelensky has been calling for, which is total madness. We have some people at home who don't know any different calling for it. Some of them should know better, and they've been calling for it. And it just shows how bloody stupid they are. It is scandalous. And all that will mean is that more and more people will die. More and more destruction will be caused. And it's like as if they don't give a damn because they're comfortable in their own nest. And it's easy if you're living in the suburbs of middle-class Dublin and you're calling for a no-fly zone. Oh, that's all grand. It won't touch you. But you know what? It'll kill more Ukrainians.
Yeah, and the people say, oh yeah, you, Claire Daly and Mick Wallace, you think you know better than the people of Ukraine. How dare you? It's not about that. The point is that whether Zelensky calls for it or not, the point is a no-fly zone is exactly as Mick has outlined. There was a no-fly zone in Libya. That country is decimated, doesn't even exist in a country, hundreds of thousands of dead. That is the perspective. You know, people looking on think that arguing for more militarism to go in is helping the situation. It's actually making it worse. And the idea that Ukraine is entirely defenseless is wrong as well, because one of the contributing factors behind this war has been the increasing militarism which Ukraine has engaged in over the past period. And even despite the difficulties in its economy, basket case in terms of corruption and economic problems and so on, even with that, they have spent billions on increasing their military might. So that's already occurred. And now against the backdrop of this war, the US, NATO and the EU is piling in billions more weaponry. But it's not enough to take on the might of the Russian army. So we come back to the longer this war goes on, the more the damage is going to be done to Ukraine. And it's very clear now to me and probably to increasing numbers of people that the US and NATO are very happy to see that war continue. What's more concerning is that Europe has gone along with that frenzy as well, because there's no attention on the Russian demands in the ceasefire. And people have said, well, how dare they? Do you mean we should give in to Russia? And we're going saying, no, that's the wrong way of looking at it. The way you have to look at it is that every war ends in a negotiated settlement, and it's far better that this would happen sooner rather than later. So Russia has put out some cards on the table, basically around, you know, Ukrainian neutrality, respect for Crimea, looking at the Donbass and Luhansk. They've said they've no interest in occupying the other cities that are currently under bombardment. So even if you don't believe the Russians, why wouldn't you take that and call their bluff on it and sit down on that? Why wouldn't the international community? So instead of saying, oh yeah, we'll talk about peace, while they're doing that, they're piling in more hardware, and Zelensky is calling for more, only prolonging the conflict. So it's a double speak that's going on. And it's shocking that none of the European countries have broken rank. Now, we see in the meeting of the European Council meeting last week that they actually ruled out Ukraine joining, fast-tracking joining the EU. Macron was the most sharp on that, sort of saying, look, it can't happen. They're at war, which is exactly what we said when we voted against the motion. And there's a process that takes year. And yet RTE are again leading today with Zelensky says the EU is going to, we're going to join the EU in a few months. They're not. And they're not going to join NATO either. And yet RTE keeps running with these sort of fake news stories with that, oh, Russia is in trouble in Ukraine, sort of like leading people. And all these, or not all these, but some people from Ireland are actually going over to join in the fighting. You know, they'll come back even as prisoners, or they'll be dead, like. And I don't know what they think they're joining or what they think they're playing at, like. But a lot of this Western propaganda around the war is fueling this as well. It seems to be mental.
The mainstream media played a very negative role, and it hasn't been one to facilitate peace, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I mean, again, it's the double standards. I mean, it's not that what's happening in Ukraine is appalling, but we have to be honest about it. The war in Yemen and the devastation in Yemen in terms of physical devastation, in terms of human casualties, in terms of the exodus of people out of that country, is substantially more than Ukraine. That doesn't mean that we think what's happening in Ukraine is awful, but it doesn't get any headlights at all. There's no sanctions of Russia, of Saudi Arabian oil. And in one day last week, they beheaded, executed 81 people in the one day. There's no sanctions. There's no callbacks for freezing of their assets. Yet each time they do that in the West, it backs Russia into a corner. That doesn't mean we're Russian sympathizers. It means we're recognizing the reality. And it means that Russian people are paying for it, not Abramovich or whatever they are, not oligarchs, ordinary Russian people are paying for it, and ordinary European people are paying for it. You like, lads, if you're not seeing it in your pockets in terms of your fuel prices, your energy prices, your shopping prices, this is all part of the sanctions and the effort that's coming in. And Russia hasn't even turned off the gas yet, which they can do. And that will be cataclysmic. You will see literally hundreds of thousands of people out of a job on that, or if that happens, if somebody doesn't be sensible and call it in here. I mean, the UN have been disgraceful as well. But can you imagine if we really were a neutral Western country on the Security Council, in the heart of the EU, what a bridge our neutral country could have been in brokering and arguing peace. And it was good to see Michael D on Patrick's Day calling for a ceasefire and reading his statement. While it wasn't that, you could see what he was trying to do, breaking through this frenzy of sort of jingoism around the war and yet be a voice of reason. Can you imagine if we really did that? We could have made a huge difference.
Yeah, and his position was a stark contrast to the Taoiseach going to New York and more or less saying, oh, listen, America, doesn't matter how many wars you start, it doesn't matter how many millions you killed, and it doesn't matter how many countries you bomb, we're witches all the way. The unconditional support that Micheál Martin was offering the Americans, to me, was really, really not good.
Well, I was never particularly a fan of De Valera, but my God, he must be absolutely, you know, his maintenance of Irish neutrality during World War II took a lot of backbone. But actually, Fianna Fáil have been way worse than Fine Gael even in this. In fairness, Simon Coveney has been a little bit more measured in the sense of trying to dumb down a lid on the frenzied Russia phobia, on the attacks on the Russian ambassador and so on. Fine Gael have been a little bit more steady than Fianna Fáil have been disgusting, using this in the most vilest manner to curry votes for themselves.
For me, it's blatantly obvious that I don't think for a second that Fianna Fáil gave a damn about the citizens of Ukraine. They didn't give a damn about the people in Afghanistan. They didn't give a damn about the people in Iraq. They didn't give a damn about the people in Syria. They didn't give a damn about the people in Yemen or Libya. Why the hell are we supposed to believe that they actually really care about the people of Yemen? I actually think this is about the next election. That they're trying to pint score over Fine Gael. And while I've heard plenty of poor comments from Fine Gaelers as well, I have to say that in general, as a unit, Fianna Fáil have been much worse than Fine Gael, and they've been trying to use it, I think, to get us a step ahead of Fine Gael for the next election. I hope the Irish people see through it.
Well, it's dreadful. I mean, playing with the lives of people in a war zone is just beyond despicable, you know. It really is. And I mean, crazy times.
And so what are the consequences of this, and what do you see as the options out? So we have on one hand the potential peace deal, and on the other hand, increasing escalation as it stands with the sanctions and everything else. And what do you foresee, and what are the current consequences of what's happening?
Well, it would be great if some of the strong players in Europe, like France and Germany, were to play a more active role in pressuring for negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. In an ideal world, we'd also like to see them working with China to pressure Russia to be more compromising at the table with Ukraine. If you're going to have negotiations, if you're going to reach a settlement, if you're going to stop the bloodshed and stop the destruction and stop this terrible war, you're going to have compromise on both sides. What would that look like? I think at this stage, the element of, I would think that it's almost an acceptable fact at this stage that Ukraine, the idea of Ukraine joining NATO is a complete non-runner. Accepting the fact that Russia has genuine security concerns has to be a starter. But Russia also has to withdraw its troops and recognize the independence of the greater Ukraine. Crimea isn't going back to Ukraine. It is going to be part of Russia, and everyone that lives in the real world knows that. So I think it's very important that Russia gets the hell out of Ukraine. And what I would like to see, Russia has recognized the independence of Donbass and Donetsk, which are part of the Donbass. And I think they're going to have to roll back on that. I think that the whole Donbass region should stay part of Ukraine, and Minsk too should be brought back alive, and it needs to be implemented where the Donbass region does get regional autonomy, does get language rights, respect for culture of the people that live in the region, but it should stay part of an independent Ukraine. Now, that's my wish list. That's what I see as a way forward. And it would be great if players like France and Germany and China, I don't expect the Americans to play a positive role in it. I don't expect NATO to play a positive role in it. Both much prefer war to peace because it feeds the military-industrial complex, suits them fine. But the people of Europe need a settlement here. It's going to have a dramatic effect also on the people of Europe. It isn't just going to cause terrible hardships to the people of Ukraine and cause so many deaths. It isn't just going to cause a big impact on the Russian economy. It will also impact dramatically on the European economy. But this can be all avoided to some degree by people just getting sensible, getting around the table and compromising.
And coming to our final point, let's just mention something else we were doing this week. We were in Vilnius on Monday to go and see Algirdas Belikis, who is on trial and accused of Russian spying. Can you talk a little bit about his appeal?
Oh, God. I mean, it seems like a month ago now, even though it was last Tuesday, the trial took place. If the Irish people were actually to watch it all taking place, if there was a film in the courthouse, we were there in November, we were there last Tuesday. If you had a film, you'd kind of wonder, is this actually a member of the European Union? The only evidence, the only witness against Algirdas being a Russian spy, the only witness is a guy who was in prison for paedophilia. And he raised his hand and said, oh, I was working with Algirdas as a Russian spy, and I facilitated him. And this paedophile is let out of prison for saying this. He turns up to the court case in November in a balaclava. He doesn't want to be seen because he's not telling the truth. And halfway through the court case in November, he told the judge that he was uncomfortable and he wanted to leave. And the judge said, that's okay. The chief witness is allowed out of the courtroom in the middle of a trial in November. So we had a trial on Tuesday, and you know what happened? The chief witness didn't turn up at all, and the judge says, Ash, that's okay.
I think even worse is that's the one evidence, inverted commas, is a convicted paedophile given sort of a testimony which can't be cross-examined and which roundly contradicted itself. The second witness or evidence is the state secret services, who said they have a secret report, which is so secret that even the judges in the case are not allowed to see the secret report, which says that Algirdas is a spy. Like, that's the other evidence, you know?
And the judges are supposed to come to a conclusion without even seeing it or hearing the same evidence?
Yeah. So
you couldn't make it up.
And I think, obviously, an accusation of being a Russian spy at the moment is really scary in the current climate. He's a writer. He had been to Russia. He had met with people who were involved in the events when Lithuania became independent in the 90s and so on. There's a whole, I suppose, history lesson in that. He met some Russians who were involved in that, talked to that, and it's because he met them as part of his book that's supposed to be the Russian spy element. It's just bogus and ridiculous. And we made the point before, and we shouldn't let it go unnoticed, that in some ways this espionage charge is similar to that of Julian Assange. And of course, it would be completely remiss of us to have this program today and not mark the fact that the UK courts this week also refused the appeal of Julian against his extradition to the United States. And to me, that is no coincidence that that is happening against the backdrop of the Russian-Ukrainian war, where all attention is there. There's no independent commentary on anything else, and they kind of snuck that in the back door. Absolutely tragic, again, violation of fundamental rights.
Yeah, with all the talk about rule of law, with all the talk about democracy, freedom of speech and human rights, how can the EU stay silent about the treatment of Julian Assange? He's rotten away in prison. He's going to be extradited to America because he told the truth about US war crimes. And the EU stays silent.
It's incredible. And I mean, it's totally true. And I suppose these are very upsetting times for so many people. I suppose if we end on maybe a slightly more positive point, because people will probably wonder, my God, you know, you're in Greece, you're in Lithuania, you know, what's it about? But actually our presence in these places does make a difference. And there's no doubt from the migrant community here and others in Greece, they felt it, and their courts felt the pressure of EU scrutiny. And one of, I suppose, a heartening example of that, and we featured it on the programme before, is our work in Bulgaria. And Bulgaria never got a look in, the poorest country in the EU. And I suppose we're happy that we played a great role alongside the citizens of Bulgaria who took to the streets in fighting corruption over the last 2 years. And we were able to join them in those protests. We've been involved many times since. We did a rule of law report there. And then brilliant news, as part of putting the spotlight on them, the European Prosecutor's Office, which is only newly established, has launched a big investigation into Bulgaria. We knew that, but yesterday they arrested Boyko Borisov, the former Prime Minister of Bulgaria. And to say that the message is coming through from our friends in Bulgaria, this is electric. This person has been responsible for the theft of tens of billions of euros belonging to the Bulgarian people. It's a testament to them that the prosecutor's office put this on their first list. He's been arrested now along with some of his henchmen and women. Nobody can believe it. It's lifted the lid kind of on, well, everybody, the lid was well lifted on the corruption in Bulgaria. All the Bulgarians knew. But the fact that outside forces are doing something about this is huge, and we can only hope that it's a serious prosecution, it's the start of it, and that it delivers. But it shows when the outside world does put the screws on other countries and the EU plays that role, it can make a difference. And I think that's something that we've been championing since we got elected to the European Parliament, and it's something that we'll continue to do.
Yeah, well, after a heavy week, let's leave it on that positive note. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.